Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll be joined by Craig Welch, environmental reporter for the Seattle Times and author of Shell Games, Rogue Smugglers and the Hunt for Nature's Bounty. We'll talk about the subjects of Shell Games, namely the massive geoduck clams that an array of crooks can't help but plunder, and the law enforcement agents who are trying to stop this underworld trade. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call is the Washington State Bird. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess what it is. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of bird made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation about the geoduck underworld with Craig Welch. Geoducks are not a type of waterfowl. Rather, they're a species of large saltwater clams native to the northern Pacific coast of Washington State and the province of British Columbia, and even Alaska. They're the largest burrowing clam in the world, weighing on average 1 to 3 pounds and sometimes more. They're also one of the world's longest living organisms with a life expectancy well over 100 years. Harvesting them is no easy task, as these clams bury themselves deep into the muddy ocean bottoms and tidal flats, with only a small tip of their siphons evidence of their presence. To show just how difficult it can be, the Discovery Channel's Dirty Jobs television show even went to a geoduck farm in 2006. Geoducks are prized for their meat and are considered a delicacy in China and elsewhere. They've been featured on a variety of cooking shows, including Top Chef, Dinner Impossible, and Extreme Cuisine with Jeff Corwin. But for today's guest, Craig Welch, geoducks represent something more than fashionable seafood. Rather, geoducks provided an entree into the dark underworld of illegal wildlife trade. By exploring this slice of the trade, Welch shows how pervasive and intricate the problem of wildlife trafficking truly is. In fact, Vermont's own Bill McKibben, author of Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, says about Craig's book, "Forget CSI, this is the real deal, tracking down the greediest kinds of criminals as they plunder the planet's future. You may think that clams are nothing special, but before this book is many pages old, you'll be rooting for the bivalves." Craig is the environmental reporter for the Seattle Times and author of Shell Games, Rogue Smugglers and the Hunt for Nature's Bounty. A journalist for 2 decades, his work has appeared in Smithsonian Magazine, The Washington Post, and Newsweek. He has won dozens of local, regional, and national journalism awards and has been named the National Society of Environmental Journalists Outstanding Beat Reporter of the Year. In 2007, he completed a fellowship at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University. Craig has hunted seals with tribal fishermen in Alaska, hitched helicopter rides with scientists in the melting Arctic, prowled the Oregon woods for endangered owls, and tracked the development of Wyoming's oil fields. In researching his book, Shell Games, Craig got an insider's look at a group of dedicated state and federal wildlife agents who have devoted years to cracking down on the lucrative trade in geoducks in the Pacific Northwest. When we spoke recently, I asked Craig how he first got interested in wildlife crime and what drew him to this story about geoducks.
Well, I work as an environmental reporter at the Seattle Times, and you know, I had been tangentially aware of environmental crime. You know, I knew sort of all of the things that I think average folks know, you know, a little bit about elephant tusks, but I didn't know anything in particular about wildlife crime until I was reading, embarrassingly enough, in my own newspaper about 3 gentlemen who had been arrested for stealing millions of dollars worth of geoduck clams. And geoduck clams are found only in the Pacific Northwest and Puget Sound, Vancouver, and Southeast Alaska. And they had been arrested by wildlife cops. And the money that they were making was, it was $3 million. And I was just floored. And it it sounded fascinating. So I went and talked to, it was a tiny little story in our newspaper, and I went and talked to the wildlife detectives who caught these gentlemen. And they said, oh, you have no idea how deep this goes. And that was sort of, that was my introduction to wildlife crime in the United States.
And so how, so you started researching wildlife crime, and how deep does it go?
You know, I felt like I had sort of touched on things at just the right time. You know, wildlife trafficking globally has, it's huge. Everybody knows that it's a large phenomenon. But one of the things that is interesting is that in the last 30 years or so, globalization has really helped create a market for wildlife inside the United States, much bigger than we'd ever thought of before. You know, you can find markets for everything from strange clams in the Pacific Northwest to butterflies from the Grand Canyon to rattlesnakes in New York. I mean, you can find pretty much something in every state for which people are interested in buying these items overseas. And because you have sort of you know, the internet and all these other opportunities to sort of make transactions, it's just more and more difficult to police. And you know, the globe is much smaller than it used to be, so it's a huge phenomenon.
And so, given all of these various species, what drew you to geoducks?
Well, you know, here's the funny thing is, so I you know, the geoduck clam, first is, I guess I should describe it. It is a...
Please do, because it's just a weird creature.
It's a fist-sized clam, but it has a neck on it, a siphon, and the siphon can stretch about the length of a man's forearm. And, you know, quite honestly, what it resembles is something that you really don't talk about on the radio. It looks very phallic and you know, frankly, sexual. And it's a strange creature, and people in the Pacific Northwest have been eating them for, you know, hundreds of years. Native Americans used to gather them off the tide flats. But only about 1970 or so did people start to actually try and find a commercial market for this. And that time frame sort of also coincides roughly with sort of the beginnings of rapid globalization. You know, in the early 70s, you had Nixon going to China, and, you know, geoducks would eventually become a really popular item in China. And part of what drew me to this story is I just couldn't understand how people on one side of the world would have such an appetite for something that's actually only found on another part of the world. So, you know, sort of the more I explored the story, the more it ended up seeming like a very great metaphor for the globalization of wildlife trafficking in the U.S.
That was something really interesting in your book, because you do trace how that happens.
The interesting thing is that you have people in the Pacific Northwest have been eating these things for years, as I said, but you also have the Pacific Northwest as sort of the gateway to the Pacific Rim. And, you know, in Vancouver, there are a lot of folks from China and Hong Kong who have sort of ended up building communities in the sort of the suburbs of Vancouver, British Columbia. And that's one of the other few places in the world where you can actually find geoducks. And there was a gentleman who had was working on the docks in Vancouver, and he came across one of these geoducks back in the late 70s, early 80s, and he thought, my goodness, this looks like something that you know, I would have eaten as banquet food back in Hong Kong. And Hong Kong and Chinese banquet food are, it's, you know, they eat large portions. They're sort of, they're known for their exotic looking, the exotic look of the food, the exotic taste, and the exotic sort of smells, and everything about them has to be unique in some way. So he actually shipped some of these to a relative who worked in a restaurant in Hong Kong, and that was the very beginning of this sort of marketplace in Asia for these creatures that are only found in the Pacific Northwest of North America.
And did it catch on immediately, or Was there a lot of marketing and advertising involved?
There was some marketing and advertising, but it caught on fairly rapidly, and part of it was a matter of timing. In the mid-80s, seafood restaurants in Hong Kong were booming. I think the number of seafood restaurants in Hong Kong tripled as a percentage of all restaurants in Hong Kong between the early 80s and the early 90s. China, and particularly the part of China directly across the water from Hong Kong, was going through its own economic expansion. You would see, I think the number of factories in Guangdong rose, I think, 1,000% over the course of about 8 years in the 80s. So just as there was sort of developing in a middle and slightly larger middle to upper class people in China, then it was sort of all at the same time that this creature was sort of arriving in restaurants in Hong Kong. And, the businessmen would start eating it, and then the next thing you know, that people were increasing in wealth wanted to sort of have the same kind of amenities that the business class had. And so the timing was just perfect.
Is it something that wealthy people eat, or has it always been something everybody, you had mentioned that traditionally people would eat it in the Pacific Northwest?
In the Pacific Northwest, it's not particularly something that was sort of a wealthy item. People would gather them off the tide flats, and they're a gooey that tastes. It's similar to a normal clam, but it's crunchier, it's sweeter, they can weigh 7 pounds, and the typical one weighs 2 to 3 pounds. But it's a lot of meat, and they're a little hard to come by because you can either find them on the tide flats or way out in deep water and such that requires diving. So. If you could actually, in the early days, if you could find them on the tide flats, they were just sort of, chopped up into chowder, and, people didn't know entirely what to do with them. And so it was not something that was sort of a big deal with the wealthy class. But over time, I think a little bit of marketing and the relative difficulty of gathering these things started increasing their sort of the profitability and the cost of getting them, and they became something of a high-dollar item.
So tell me why we should care about gooey ducks. What's special about them? You describe them, and they certainly seem a little special. But biologically, are they interesting?
Biologically, they're very interesting creatures. And so clams and shellfish and oysters in general, they're filter feeders, so they help keep water clean. And, in the Pacific Northwest, there are all sorts of shellfish. We have horse clams and manila clams, but, sort of one of our bedrock shellfish species is the gooey duck clam. And gooey ducks are long-lived. Each of these things can live up to 150 years.
And what? 150 years?
150 years, exactly. And we just don't know an awful lot about how important they are to the biological system. But what we do know is long-lived creatures are very difficult to replace. If you over-harvest something that is actually, that lives for a long time, it's very difficult to know whether or not we're able to sort of maintain them in perpetuity, because it takes generations to sort of figure out what the sort of human impact is. And in the Pacific Northwest, we've learned the hard way. We have our two biggest iconic species are salmon and old growth forest. And if you look at the history of both of those, what we've learned is that we've over-harvested salmon, and now we have in Puget Sound, we have endangered and threatened species of salmon in Puget Sound and also in the Columbia River. And that we harvested timber for homes throughout the 20th century. And by the end of the 20th century, we realized that we had logged 85% of the old growth forest in the Pacific Northwest. So, and the impact of that was, there were, spotted owls and all sorts of other creatures that are no longer, they're actually sort of slowly dying out because of what we did to the habitat. And so I guess the bottom line is we know gooey ducks are important because they sort of are they filter water and in Puget Sound and elsewhere in the Pacific Northwest, what we don't know is what we could take safely. And then, you know, thirdly, what we do know is that we have a bad track record of trying to judge what's safe.
Are they a protected species? Do we know if they're threatened or endangered?
No, they are not protected at all. In fact, you know, I mean, one of the interesting things about this particular story is, you know, much as was the case with, you know, timber and salmon, these are not endangered species. They are thought to be incredibly commonplace in Puget Sound and in Vancouver and Southeast Alaska. But what we do know is that the way you protect species and keep them from becoming endangered is you actually have to set up some kind of system where you don't take them, you know, for lack of a better term, willy-nilly. And that's what rules are for. And what happened in the Pacific Northwest is that we set very strict harvest rules, and almost immediately people started finding illegal ways to get around them, around those rules, and the illegal harvest ended up being a substantial portion of the overall harvest. And, you know, as this sort of goes on into the future, we presume that we're not driving things into some kind of threatened status. But, you know, the biologists actually will admit to you right up front that, you know, they're basing this all on mathematical models, and they don't actually know.
So they don't really know how many geoducks are out there, what the population
is. They know how many geoducks are out there. What they don't know is how many have actually been harvested. And that's what's really fascinating, is that, you know, unlike, you know, fish or other creatures, I mean, the geoducks are taken by scuba divers, and they're taken from under the water, and they're often taken in the dead of night. And it's almost impossible to actually correctly tally how many geoducks are actually taken. And so, again, they are sort of basing their harvest quotas on models. And, you know, what frequently happens is they will go out and they will survey places and find out that a huge percentage of the clams that they thought were taken, what ended up being withdrawn was much larger than that.
Do you have an idea of how much larger?
You know, it varies from place to place. There was one survey that biologists did where they sort of mapped out a little area of Puget Sound and went in and realized that anywhere from 30 to 40% more geoducks had been taken than were allowed to be taken legally just in one season. And, you know, these things are taken pretty much every day of the year, 365 days a year, and they've been doing that for 30 years. So they, you know, all they knew is that that was a really big warning sign.
The geoducks, how do they attach themselves to the ground? Tell me more about their biology.
Yeah, they're,
they're
fascinating creatures. So these shellfish sort of spawn in the water, and, you know, the male and female portions meet in the water, and then when they actually form a larva, the larva will end up growing into a tiny little shellfish, and the shellfish will eventually drop to the bottom of the water body and land in the dirt, and there's a tiny little foot at the end of a shell, and the foot starts digging into the dirt, and as it's digging, the geoduck will grow. And the shell will end up growing to be about fist size, and you know, the siphon will sort of slowly stretch to the surface of the water, and the geoduck eventually just embeds itself in the muck at the bottom of the water. And so they end up sort of, they're like forests underwater. These creatures will stay there, and they would stay there for life. They don't move. They don't, you know, get up like crabs and walk around. They're just fixed in this environment.
So their foot really just digs in, but it doesn't...
It just digs in, and the siphon basically pokes through to the water, and it will draw in water and filter it and then exhale it through, they're sort of like double-barreled, and it will exhale it through another side of the siphon, and the exhaled water will have been sort of cleaned of all the phytoplankton and other sort of stuff that the clam is ingesting.
So if you looked underneath the water, you know, on the muddy bottom, you would just see little straw-like things poking out?
Well, yeah, what you actually see is it would look like binocular lenses, and they would be sort of these two double barrels, or it would be like if somebody had buried a shotgun with the shotgun facing up, and all you can see is just these two little circles side by side in sort of a figure eight formation, and they will stick out maybe a quarter of an inch.
But that's if you actually,
that's it. And if you were to grab that just with your fingertips and grab that quarter of an inch and then dig away 2 or 3 feet down, what you would see is this long fleshy neck that goes into a shell at the very bottom.
When it's siphoning in the water, what is it eating?
It's basically, it's sucking in water and it's basically drawing all of the nutrients out of the water. So it's, phytoplankton and, all the other micronutrients in the water. And then it's exhaling water that's clean. And that's the way, that's the way most shellfish feed.
And are they, you had said that they're only found in the Pacific Northwest, is that right?
That's right. There are a little bit, you can find them a little bit sporadically and sort of from Northern California up through sort of the Oregon coast, but that's just the very southern end of their range. There's almost nothing. You'd find them very few and far between. But from Puget Sound, basically the southeast Alaska, is sort of that's their home turf, so to speak. And you can't find, they're related species other places in the globe, but nothing as big and not as plentiful.
And what kind of habitat do they like?
They like cold water, and it has to be sort of this nice grainy sand, and you can actually, it's interesting, the flesh on a geoduck will sort of change colors depending on sort of whether or not they're in sort of a rocky substrate or a sort of muddy bottom, but ideally they like the sort of muddy bottom in Puget Sound, and it's all, Puget Sound is all formed by glaciers, and, if there's something about the glacial till that seems to be there, what was fascinating to me is when I sort of really tried to get people to explain why they would be here and not someplace else in the world, when push comes to shove, people are still not entirely sure. I mean, it's just one of the beauties of writing about nature is that, we learn things every day, but we don't always know the answer. And people aren't sure why they're here and not in, say, off of the Atlantic coast.
What do you do with them? You had said that you eat them. How do you prepare
sure,
them?
Sure, and here's what was sort of fascinating for me as somebody who was trying to write about wildlife crime. In the early part of the 20th century, people would just take these things and cut them up, and, they would be just like clams, and they would make clam chowder out of them. But once they got to Asia in the late 70s, early 80s, they became really popular as sashimi because they're sort of very, very fresh and have like a nice sort of bright oceany flavor to them. In China, people use them in a sort of a fondue-like dish called hot pot. But then they're also, they're really popular in high-end restaurants in places like L.A. and Hong Kong and New York City. And they're sort of carved into these sort of fancy dishes of everything from cheese casserole souffle and it's just they can make wonderful just all sorts of different dishes.
They taste like any kind of clam, or do they have some sort of
special? No, they have their own unique flavor. I mean, they're sort of because the clams are so big that they seem to gather a little more sugar. And so they're a little bit sweeter, and they have sort of a slight, almost fruity tang to them, and they taste, some fish taste very oceany. These taste oceany, but in a very fresh way. It sounds silly to say, but it is sort of like a burst of freshness, It's true.
And what color?
I have tasted them, and they're it's definitely an acquired taste, but they're very fresh. And the color, they're generally, it's very sort of creamy white.
You had said that they'll change color based on if they're in the rocky substrate or the...
Exactly. And sometimes they're sort of this sort of ugly looking gray color. We've all seen shellfish that don't look terribly healthy, and that's what they look like when they're buried in the rocks too much.
Are they browner on a muddy bottom?
On a muddy bottom, they would be sort of whiter and creamier. It's on a rockier bottom that they would be sort of dirtier.
Oh, interesting.
And I'm not entirely sure why.
Tell me about what it takes to harvest them.
Well, and here's what's really fascinating is that because these creatures are they're found on the shoreline and but they're not common on the shoreline, and you can only dig them by hand when the tide is at its lowest, which is only happens a dozen times a year. So in the late 60s, a scuba diver discovered that they actually are found in great number in deep water. So to harvest these things, scuba divers actually go out from boats, and they're tethered by basically it's called hookah gear. And so they're actually, instead of actually carrying tanks, they're actually connected by an air hose to a boat, and they literally walk with heavy shoes and weighted waist belts along the bottom until they see some of these sort of siphons poking through from the muck. And they get down there with a jet sprayer, and they dig these clams out, and they sort of blow away the muck and will pull out a clam by hand. And each of these things weighs 2.5 pounds or so. And they will fill up a mesh bag with these, and then they will attach the mesh bag to a line and draw the line up to a boat. And the reason that this is such a sort of hotbed of crime is that, because it's done someplace where you can't see them, the only way wildlife enforcement can make sure that people are staying within their quota is that they require divers to work only during the daytime. And when the clams arrive at the top of the boat and people leave for the day, they actually have to check in with a law enforcement officer who is sitting on a boat watching the harvest every day of the year. And that person will, they will check and see sort of how many clams are coming off the water that day. In the late 80s or early 90s, people of a more criminal bent discovered that, the market was really hot for these clams in Asia. So they could figure out that if you tie a bag of clams to the bottom of the boat and drive off with them, then the wildlife enforcement folks wouldn't know how many you were taking. Or they would pull the clams out and leave them in a bag on the bottom, and then they would come out in the middle of the night and draw the bag up. And people were taking literally tens of thousands, in some cases hundreds of thousands of clams illegally that way.
Has there been an attempt to change that law? Or how could you even police that, I guess? It's a difficult thing when it's underwater and at night.
It is a difficult thing, and that is part of the reason that I ended up having what I hope people would find is a very strange and interesting story to write. In the early 1990s, what happened is the state and federal agents started realizing that people were taking these clams by the tens of thousands illegally. And so they started trying to deal with it the way you deal with all sorts of sort of massive organized crime. They got together a network of informants, and they started doing undercover operations to try and catch people doing this illegally. And it turned into this multi-year saga of people trying to figure out how to stop this crime wave underwater. And I think at this point, what they discovered is that they don't have a great way to stop it. All they can do is try and police it once it gets on the surface. So what they know how much a particular quota, the quota for Puget Sound is overall. They know how many clams should be going out. And what they do is they end up frequently checking sort of airport log records and the markets around the world. And they discover that, sometimes 10, 20, 30% more clams are actually being sold than are allowed to be taken. And they end up doing a lot of their criminal enforcement by working backwards from that.
Now, your book follows this array of crooks, both crooks and investigators, who mm-hmm. spend years immersed in this gooey duck underworld. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, and you have some wild stories, and I'm wondering if you could tell me about both some of the characters and some of the stories.
Sure. I mean, so the way the book starts in the early 1990s, and it starts with a Washington State wildlife detective. It's a gentleman named Ed Voles, And Ed Voles has been working in wildlife enforcement since the mid-70s. He grew up in Washington. He's a Pacific Northwest guy. He policed salmon and salmon fishing and tried to stop poachers from taking too many salmon back in the 70s. Along about the early 1990s, he started hearing that there were people were taking way too many shellfish from Puget Sound. He wasn't entirely sure what to do about it, but he knew that the only way to really stop these crimes is to have a network of informants. So one day, a gentleman gets arrested for taking too many abalone from Puget Sound, and the cop who arrests him calls Ed Voles and says, "Well, you might want to meet this guy." Ed Voles interviews the gentleman and realizes that this particular gentleman has been stealing abalone by the tens of thousands for years, but now they have him on a crime, and they've got him right in front of him, and the cops say, "Well, look, would you be willing to work with us and go out and basically be an informant for us?" And this gentleman agrees to work with the police, goes out, and while he's out working with the cops, he basically helps them realize that, abalone used to be a big market in Puget Sound, but it's nothing compared to the illegal market for gooey ducks. And, they have this gentleman going, and he is meeting in restaurants with business folks who are trying to buy gooey ducks illegally from him, and they want to sell them to countries all over the world, particularly countries in Southeast Asia and China. He works with them for about a year, and things seem to be going rather well. But at one point, he goes out to start his boat, and the boat blows up. And he's terribly injured. He ends up being in the hospital for weeks on end. And at this point, the cops don't know whether it was just something that he did accidentally, if he'd had been taking poor care of his boat, or if there had been some kind of sabotage. But what it does is it makes them realize that they have a potentially sort of dramatic and dangerous subworld, subculture out there. And they start putting more resources into it. And the next thing you know, there are federal agents involved. And they are sort of deep into this world, and every year it seems that they find that the world is bigger and bigger and that the crimes are more and more dramatic.
When you think of sabotaged boats and whatnot, you think of drug running and
exactly,
terrorism.
It's funny because what these officers say is that, they have a bit of a chip on their shoulder because they're people who work in the wildlife enforcement realm don't think they get enough respect. These folks will tell you that it's much like policing drugs, except, if you find heroin sitting on a table, you know that a crime has been committed. If you see a pile of gooey ducks, that doesn't mean anything. It's only illegal if they're taken from the wrong time or from the wrong place or at the wrong time of year. And each of those sort of rules changes depending on which particular species that you're trying to protect. So if somebody is taking gooey duck or if they're taking abalone, it's like you have to be aware of all of these rules, and policing this crime ends up being incredibly complicated. But because the crimes are so complicated, it's very difficult to make arrests. And because people don't see this world the same as they see sort of drugs and, gun running or something like that, the penalties are much slimmer. So it's actually fairly easy to set up and illegal network and sort of start to try and make money illegally in this, and the risks are lower because the penalties if you actually get caught are so much lower.
So tell me, how much how much profit are we talking about? How much does a gooey duck sell for?
I'm sorry, I should have told you this earlier. That part of what the fascination here is that a gooey duck clam is 2.5 pounds. And, gooey duck, I think right now gooey duck sells for $14 a pound wholesale. So a single clam in just at the wholesale level in American dollars can be worth $50. And you can go out in an afternoon in a couple hours and you can pull up, 500 pounds of these things. So you can make an awful lot of money. And if you have the skill and the strength to go out and dive at night, you can make a lot of money without having to pay taxes, without having to do anything that a normal harvester could. I mean, you can make $2,000 in a night. And so what you have is you'd have folks who would go out and sort of buy the gear, and they would go out and they would harvest during the day legally, and then they would hire a second crew and go out at night and harvest illegally, and they would make 4 or 5 times as much money at night as they would make legally during the day, but then they would have all of the paperwork that they sort of mix it all together and make it appear legal.
When it gets to Asia, how much is that same clam worth?
That same clam in Hong Kong can sell for $100. And, you know, you can, I mean, the amount of money to be made is just astronomical. And it, you know, it changes with market forces, but in some cases, people have actually told me that they've seen clams for sale for $200 in Hong Kong. So, I mean, you can go out and spend, you know, 7 minutes digging out a clam, and that clam would be worth $200 on the other side of the world. And if you do that, you know, 4 nights a week for a year, I mean, suddenly you're talking about millions of dollars.
On the opposite side of that, so you had said the penalties are really low. So What happens when you get caught?
Generally what happens is you get a fine. And, you know, in some cases people get jail time. And so that's what was particularly frustrating to these wildlife enforcement officers in the 1990s. And so what they decided they were going to try and do is they were going to try and treat this like you would any other sort of organized crime. And they would try and police this as like using RICO statutes. They would do an organized crime case, which would mean that they would sort of try and find people sort of all contributing to the conspiracy. It ends up being a much more difficult thing to police, but, you know, you can actually get penalties that way. And that was how federal agents ended up getting involved. And the federal agents realized that they could, if they had the right informant, they could maybe make cases against a lot of these folks, and they, you know, eventually lead themselves, all these folks could actually lead them to the kingpin of this dark underworld. And that was what they were hoping. What they didn't realize is that they had taken on an informant who had some ideas of his own.
Yeah, so I was about to ask you about that. One of the confidential informants you talk about is this Gui Duc Diver, who's also a convicted felon and a Native American, so Doug Tobin. And I wanted you to tell me a little bit about him. Did you get to meet him?
I did. I met Doug Tobin a couple different times, and he is he's an incredibly gregarious guy, and he's very funny, and he's a big fellow, but, you know, he likes to laugh, and he tells great stories, and, you know, you could sort of tell that's why law enforcement loved him as an informant. So Doug Tobin in the mid-1990s was just a Gui Duc fisherman, and he started noticing that all around him, people were breaking the law, and it frankly was making him very angry, because he thought that they were sort of cutting in on his business, and they had an unfair competitive advantage. And somebody suggested that he go and talk to the wildlife cops and offer himself up as an informant. And he did. And the wildlife cops, having just been through dealing with their previous informant who'd gotten himself hurt in this boat explosion, they decided that they wanted the benefit of Doug Tobin's insight, but they weren't sure that they could handle him on their own. So they took Doug Tobin to a federal agent, a gentleman named Special Agent Richard Sievertson. And Sievertson had been working undercover in the wildlife trade for decades. And Sievertson met Doug Tobin and frankly fell in love. Doug Tobin was just so gregarious and a great storyteller, and Sievertson himself was very much the same. And he thought he knew exactly how he could put this guy to work to sort of help catch the bad guys. But what he didn't count on is that Doug Tobin had, he was always playing both sides of the fence. So he liked to go out and he would, just like any other criminal enforcement case, he would wear a wire and he would go out and sort of talk to bad guys and try and get them on tape talking about the crimes they were committing. But then he was also secretly making side deals, and the feds didn't know about any of this stuff. And, you know, as the years wore on, they started realizing that, you know, they might have had more on their hands than they realized.
Actually, a review of Shell Games in the Washington Post talks about this and says, you know, in large part, the book is driven by one question. At the end of the day, whose side is Tobin on?
that's true. And, you know, the relationship between the cops and Doug Tobin lasted almost a decade. And, you know, it's very interesting because, you know, he did. He was a great help to them. But they never really knew whether or not, in the end, he was working for them or working for himself or both. And, you know, that is the tension that drives the story.
What makes for a good informant?
Yeah, a good informant, and that's part of the problem that they face, is a good informant is somebody like Doug Tobin. Doug Tobin had been, you know, he was, when they met him, he was in his mid-40s. In his early 20s, he had been sent to prison as a, had been involved in a violent crime. He and his brother had been convicted of beating up a football player who had insulted one of them at a bar. And they'd beaten him so badly that they'd ended up being, you know, facing prison time for assault. So you have to be a little rough around the edges. You have to be really, really smart. And, you know, I mean, cops are used to dealing with bad guys as informants. I mean, that's how it works. You have to be somebody who can be completely believable when you're, you know, sort of working with an underworld. But at the same time, you know, they have to figure out, in the end, ultimately, it's about making cases. And when you actually police an underworld like this, you have to be able to put your informant on the stand and have him testify. And that requires somebody who can actually be honest. And part of what happened in Doug Tobin's case is that, you know, Doug Tobin always pretended that he had never actually committed any crimes, that he had always been framed for everything. And when the U.S. Attorney's Office decided that they were ready to make a bunch of arrests based on all the information that Doug Tobin had provided, she had to meet Doug Tobin and decide how he was going to be on the stand. And she was very disappointed in his unwillingness to admit to his previous crimes. And you know, a lot of the cases early on ended up having to be thrown out because she could not get him to tell the truth.
We've all learned in public life, the cover-up is worse than the crime.
Yes, and Doug Tobin was all about the cover-up. And, you know, and the amazing thing is that at that point in the story, I mean, that's still the early stages of the story. The relationship between the cops and Doug Tobin would go on for years. And, you know, at one point, they would actually, the state detectives would actually, they were trying to convince their own bosses and the agencies that regulate the Gwinnett clam trade that there was a problem out there with people stealing. So they actually put together a video presentation using Doug Tobin to talk about all of the ways that Gwinnett crime was dangerous and to the resources of Puget Sound. And Doug Tobin would get on this videotape and he would detail all the ways people steal, and he would talk about what a horrific thing it is for people to steal clams. And, you know, at some point the cops started suspecting that maybe he was actually stealing as well.
As we're talking about Tobin possibly being a crook, which I won't ask you whether he was or wasn't because I don't want to give away.
Sure.
But, you know, I'm curious if you could tell me about some of the crooks that were caught based on this evidence.
Sure. So, you know, I would say the most dramatic story is that Doug Tobin, they would use Doug Tobin as an informant, just like you would use an informant in a drug ring. He would go out and he would have a tape recorder in his breast pocket, and he would go and meet with these folks and talk to them about, you know, what they were up to. And at some point, you know, if they confessed their crimes, the cops would be listening in. They would either listen to tapes later, or sometimes they would listen in on his phone calls with these folks. Well, at one point, Doug Tobin actually called the federal agents and said, "You're not going to believe what I just heard." He had gotten a call from one of the biggest Gwinnett brokers, a gentleman who lived in Las Vegas, and this gentleman said that he was so tired of another Gwinnett broker undercutting his prices that he had decided to hire a hitman to blow him up in his truck. And Doug Tobin called federal agents and said this, and the federal agents, you know, they freaked out. They said, oh my gosh, this is, suddenly we have violence we have to worry about. They called Doug Tobin in, and they said, we've got to figure out how to get to the bottom of this. And they met with Doug and said, you know, you need to go and get some of this on tape. You need to find a way, find an excuse to call this guy back and have him describe what he wants done. And so over the course of several days in 1997, there are these series of phone calls between this gentleman in Las Vegas and Doug Tobin talking about and detailing all the attempts that this guy wants to make to hire a hitman to basically off one of his rivals. Well, during these conversations...
Which basically indicates how high stakes this really is.
Exactly,
money
exactly.
You're talking about.
Exactly, and you know, and that's just one of the cases. There have been other cases where other boats have been blown up. You know, there have been other sort of insinuations of violence, but this was the first time that the federal agents sort of had something right there within their grasp. But at the same time, they have to worry about whether or not this is going to happen outside their control, and that somebody might actually get hurt. And so what they decided to do is they decided to have Doug Tobin basically try and convince the broker in Las Vegas to hire him, to hire Doug as the hitman. And it turns into this sort of amazing little cat and mouse where Doug Tobin ends up becoming a phony hitman while federal wildlife agents are listening in to this crime. They do end up actually catching the guy, but... whether or not somebody actually gets hurt ends up being, it's not clear for quite some time.
You could just see this as a movie, you know.
Well, there are definitely, you know, I'm not sure that the, you know, the movie going audiences are really prepared for a Gooey Duck yet. But, I think the story is actually pretty amazing. The hitman that the Las Vegas broker wanted to hire before Doug. Had claimed himself, they claimed that he had been a retired sheriff's deputy in Los Angeles, which turned out to be true. He also claimed that he had been a driver for mob figures, which may or may not be true. And he says that he had actually helped train Robert De Niro in a movie. When the federal agents eventually do meet the hitman, the would-be hitman, he is huge. He's about 6'2", 280 pounds, and they watch him get off the plane carrying no luggage but a stuffed teddy bear. And at some point, the federal agents find a way to ask him why he's carrying the bear, and he says, well, I'm really afraid of flying, and I need to have the bear with me at all times. And so it's just a very Elmo Leonard moment.
It definitely could be a summer adventure flick.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, it ends up being a nice way to talk about wildlife crime in general in the U.S. because there are so many other cases in other parts of the country that end up having a lot of these elements. And there's a story that I tell in the book about a butterfly smuggler in the Grand Canyon in Los Angeles who is basically caught in a 3-year undercover operation by a fish and wildlife detective, a U.S. fish and wildlife agent, who ends up going undercover to catch him while he is also working undercover to catch a group that is trying to kill a group of gentlemen who actually go out and kill birds for sport. And so this gentleman is undercover sometimes on the same day in two different personalities trying to catch bad guys. So, I mean, it's sort of the dramatic elements of these people, these agents' lives are, I mean, there's sort of something in every state of the country.
Now, that was something interesting about Shell Games is, one, you had this very odd creature as a main character, the Gooey Duck, but also you talked a lot about wildlife trade of other species, and, you know, how do Gooey Ducks compare with the wildlife trade of other species? Is it harder to deal with because it's a marine species, or...
That's interesting because, you know, there are a lot of, I think people generally think of the wildlife trade, the illegal wildlife trade, and they think of terrestrial species. They think of you know, birds or snakes or reptiles. But, you know, I mean, there is a market for just about everything right now. And, you know, the marine trade is something that is equally profitable, but it's much harder to police because, you know, so much of it is done underwater. And, you know, there are sort of it's very difficult to police that trade. And, you know, in the geoduck world, the profits are much, much larger than they are in many other types of crime. The butterfly gentleman was considered basically the world's most notorious butterfly smuggler. He was smuggling butterflies all over the world. And he, at some point, had told this federal agent who was working undercover that, you know, he had a collection worth $500,000. Well, $500,000 is nothing in the geoduck trade. People can make a couple $1 million a year easy. And there were several criminal folks who were making more than that in 1 year.
And what, you know, as a writer in researching this story, what were some of the strangest adventures or crimes that you ran across?
Well, there were certainly plenty. You know, I was disappointed to learn that right as I finished my book and turned it in, within weeks, there was an announcement in upstate New York about a 2-year undercover operation where folks had been taking reptiles and I think they were timber rattlers from upstate New York, and they were putting them in the door jams of pickup trucks and then illegally driving them over the border to Canada, where they would then be sold to pet dealers. There are really slender, small, sort of finger-sized eels that can be found along the Atlantic seaboard that people were, especially in the late 90s when the market was high, people would catch these things illegally and sell them for food in Japan. There are, as odd as it sounds, there are actually still today cactus rustlers working in Texas and in parts of Arizona. Cactus rustlers, folks who will go out, and sometimes even in places like national parks, and they will, in the dead of night, dig up a saguaro and find a way to get it in a flatbed truck and then drive it to, you know, someplace in Los Angeles where they will be used for some kind of lawn ornamentation. And that's actually a surprisingly large trade. You still have folks in the Oregon and Alaska areas digging up mushrooms and selling mushrooms illegally. I mean, it's the variety is astounding.
What was the hardest thing about researching this book?
You know, I think the hardest thing for me was getting the federal government to give up the documentation that actually showed just how significant the problem was. The wonderful thing about trying to tell stories involving police agencies is that they have to document everything. And so every time there was an undercover operation, every time an informant had a telephone call, there were transcripts and, you know, written, often in narrative form, or written descriptions of a day's events. At one point, while there was an interrogation of a suspected geoduck poacher, several of the federal agents actually described the way that they could see him puffing on his pipe and exhaling so much smoke that it was actually filling the room above his head. And those are wonderful descriptions when you're trying to actually sort of recreate a scene that you didn't witness. But the federal government was very difficult to actually get documents, and I ended up FOIAing a lot of them, but I actually had a lot of help along the way before I was able to track all that stuff down, and it ended up requiring about 30,000 pages of documentation.
Wow. Well, I really appreciate the time that you took to talk with me today.
Well, thank you, Laurel. I really appreciate you calling.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about wildlife crime and the geoduck underworld with Craig Welch, author of Shell Games, Rogues, Smugglers, and the Hunt for Nature's Bounty. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is the sound of the Washington state bird. It's fairly common and is also the state bird of New Jersey and Iowa. They have short conical bills. In spring and early summer, adult males are bright yellow with a black forehead, black wings with white markings, and white patches both above and beneath the tail. Adult females are duller yellow beneath, olive above. Winter birds are drab, unstreaked brown with blackish wings and two pale wing bars. Have you guessed it yet? It's an American goldfinch. Listen to the tweets of the American goldfinch. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.